You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
So you just said you're totally ready. So I thought I'd press record. There you are.
Fine by me.
I like the fact that for those of you listening in black and white, there's a katana behind Sean's left ear, which is a very sharp Japanese sword, which I presume is used for negotiating at some point. Is that?
Oh, no. Occasionally I joke about it. No, it's actually my grandfather's from the, well, he fought in World War II and it came back with him. Let's just put it that way. So, that's as authentic as it gets, basically.
There's some guy somewhere going, God, do you know, I'm sure I put that sword down over there just now.
Right. Right. Exactly. Used to have the scabbard, but that eventually faded away. It was like a leather scabbard. So now it just sits up on kind of a mount. It came to me after my father passed away a few years ago. And so, you know, there's a few things back there. That's all my loves up there. There's that Safeco Field up there. I'm a big baseball fan. And the thing below it is Magic Mile, which is one of the runs on Timberline. And then there's an Irish proverb in there. The only thing I can't really reasonably fit in there, well, my other love is fishing and camping. So you can't really hang a tent on the wall. And a fishing rod's a little big and a fish is a little big. So, you know, it's kind of
Hang on. Let's just see that again. The size of the fish, ladies and gentlemen, that Sean just demonstrated
I do actually, believe it or not, above my office, like it again came from my dad. There's a 40-inch muskie that we caught, which is actually bigger than my hands now, when I was like in grammar school and we caught it together. And so I need to get that mounted. But no, I mean, most of the fish I catch these days are this big, that big, somewhere in there. But I've caught some salmon that are bigger. But anyway.
And for those of you who aren't watching in video, Sean has just demonstrated again a fish that is beyond all human capacity to sort of you've caught the only, you know, so that's and the Irish proverb, tell me what's that.
Oh, it's just basically, may the road rise to meet you, may the wind be always at the back, may the sun shine warm upon your face, the rains fall soft upon your fields, until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. So anyway,
yeah, P.S.
The Irish were always good poets.
Yeah, you normally, they always leave the bit at the end that they always leave off is, it's now your round.
You've had the
so it looks like, and the last piece of the puzzle is this map of what looks like part of the world. Is that the
extends off the other way? I've always liked maps. I'm a big history buff. I don't know, I've always had an interest in kind of military history and world history, and so, you know, I've always liked geography and that kind of thing, so having a map there is pretty natural. But yeah, no, it's not just Africa, Europe, and the Pacific. If you had a wider frame view, we'd get the rest of the world on the other side of the wall.
Hey, look, listen, there's nothing wrong with my camera, okay? It's your side that's letting the show down. But Sean, exactly. I'm delighted to have you on. So, Sean, you're the founder and CEO of Cascade Insights. And I always think, you know, that you're going to do a much better job of explaining what your company does. So tell us a bit, just tell us, you know, Cascade Insights, what's the overview? What's the sort of summary?
Sure. No, and I appreciate that, because like when I've given conference talks over the years, it always drives me a little crazy because somebody will come in and try to do your intro and like,
I don't want to just read it out. Yeah.
You know, they read it out or they butcher it or they highlight like the weirdest bits that were of interest to them. And you're kind of like, please, for the love of God, don't do my intro. Right. And they're terrified you're going to go up and give like a 97-minute intro. So I'll make it kind of brief. Is basically, I am the CEO of Cascade Insights. In fairness to my business partner, it's been jointly owned since we started. But basically, we work for B2B technology companies, which we define as cloud services companies or hardware companies. And for them, the large majority of what we do is market research, but we also do some marketing services for them, because our main client in a B2B technology company is a B2B marketer who's either experiencing some kind of market pain or they've got some kind of market opportunity they want to take advantage of. And that's basically been us since 2006. And we're about 30 employees or so. I used to say based in Portland, but when COVID hit, We'd been making noises about closing our offices before that. And the minute we did it, like half the staff went to different points of the compass. They were like, I always wanted to go live in Bend. And so then they were gone. And so now we're spread across the whole US at this point.
Which is great. So the important thing is your business is very much focused on B2B. So in other words, you don't deal directly with the end consumer and you're focused on technology businesses. So again, what was the beginnings, as it were? So where did the business come from?
Well, the business originally came from, there's a business before this business. So there's kind of a, you know, business before a BB, I guess. But like, so that business was Three Leaf Solutions. And Three Leaf Solutions, when I stepped out into entrepreneurship, basically came from me and two other guys wanting to kind of co-brand as independent trainers. And I use independent a little bit loosely because we were training a lot of Microsoft technology at the time when Microsoft was 97% of what everybody used, right? I mean, this pre-cloud, this is when Windows was dominant, all this kind of stuff. And we were teaching like networking, databases, programming. But we went out to become independent trainers from this outfit we previously worked for, all three of us. There were just three of us, that three of us left out of four total instructors. So that's a whole nother story about us leaving this small company. But anyway, so we start the first company, we co-brand, we build a business, we start selling to Microsoft. That leads to selling that business. Then that leads to this business. And then this business has started in 2006. So I've been basically an entrepreneur for 21 years now.
Yes. At this point. Yeah. And but I mean, the interesting thing is that when you started this, or when you got involved in the early 2000s, it was very much, you know, early days of, you know, the internet, early days of, you know, I think we had probably what, you know, Windows 2000 or, you know, still.
Yeah, you got it. It was Windows 2000, Windows XP, right? I mean, it was that kind of era of computing, right? I mean, it was. The internet existed. I vividly remember in 1999 seeing, or somewhere around that, don't quote me on the year, I'd have to go look at Wikipedia, but like Google in beta. I mean, I actually remember vividly seeing Google with a beta sticker on it, you know, or something like that. So it was early internet. I mean, for sure. I mean, everything was done on-premise, you know, in terms of software installations, all that kind of stuff.
And again, so I suppose the major challenges from your side then, and probably still now, is you've got tech companies that are building solutions on, you know, B2B solutions. But I guess if you're training those, what comes out of that is you find that they're building stuff either where the audience doesn't exist. In other words, they're, you know, creating.
Sure.
If you build it, they will come. And I can cast my mind back to the early 2000s where enterprise software, again, was unfathomable in terms of how you use it. It was sold as infinitely configurable, but no one actually knew how to configure anything. So is that still very much the case today? Again, tell us more about the type of people.
No. I mean, like, I think the biggest thing, I mean, I'll give you like a very recent example. Like we hired, I don't want to say new because it's kind of a new position for us. It's like we had somebody in the role who kind of grew up into it, but now we hired somebody from the outside who's had a lot of experience with this as a director of operations for the company, kind of all the back-end systems. And I was having a conversation with him just the other day, kind of on this point about usability. And I said, you know, it's fascinating because we have a fairly young company. It's fairly full of millennials and they have incredibly low tolerance for software that, even if it has a good business purpose, it sucks to reuse. Like it's poorly used, you know, it just doesn't make sense. It's hard to administer. It's hard to use. So I think the bar for that is way higher than it used to be back in the day, like you said. I mean, back in the day, back office software was job security for a bunch of people because it was just really, really hard to use in many cases. And now the bar is that, you know, a lot of people should be able to kind of use that software pretty readily. I mean, that's not to say there aren't really complex software packages and installations in use today. There certainly are. But I think as a rule, software has gotten a little more beautiful, a little more usable, and a little more easy to configure kind of, I would almost say every year that I've ever used software. I mean, there's some exceptions to that, like if new spaces get created or new areas. But I mean, to be honest, you give somebody a Mac these days, and or even a Windows machine. I'm not much of a Windows guy anymore, but like, I don't know. My family uses Macs all day long and they have for years and they don't call anybody for help. They don't talk to anybody. They kind of just get stuff done, right? And there was a day where you couldn't go more than 2 days without your computer keeling over and dying in an office setting, right? And so we're way, way, way past those days now.
And again, describe a typical customer engagement.
Well, a typical customer engagement usually falls under like what I say, either pain or opportunity driven. So from a pain standpoint, they're facing a competitive landscape problem. They're facing like a competitor who's essentially doing better than them at marketing or sales or delivering a product. And from an opportunity standpoint, they either have like a new area of the globe, you know, that they want to go serve. They have a new customer segment they want to serve. Maybe it's an alignment thing with a new offering that they're merging into their company that they purchased. And that's all opportunity driven. But in either one of those cases, usually they lack a certain amount of information. They lack a certain amount of knowledge about the space they're moving to or where the competitive threat is coming from. And then they'll call us to basically help investigate that threat. Because to paraphrase something I heard the other day, right? I mean, most business leaders, they kind of exist to make decisions all day long. And if people are bothered by that language, like, should it be more communal or collegial? I mean, I would say get over it a little bit, because at the end of the day, yes, even if it's communal and collegial, people, somebody's still got to make a decision. And so those decisions are based on the quality of information they receive. And so our goal is to make that quality of information that much greater, so then they can make effective decisions. And of course, we'll also coach them through the recommendations from our studies on what decisions they should make. But that's basically it. I mean, honestly, it hasn't changed for 15 years. People either come to us for pain or opportunity. And to be honest, probably 80% of the time it's pain, because pain drives activity more than opportunity does. You know, you can always look at a green field and say, I think we can figure that out. What happens on the opportunity side is normally they've tried it. They tried to go to a new market, a new geo, address a new customer segment, and they can't quite figure out why it isn't working. So in a weird way, that's pain just kind of driven a little differently again.
I mean, in your blog on your website, which is you know, full of really interesting information, you talk about, you know, making your customers love you, and historically where people would hate their, you know, software with a vengeance. So do you find that the people that you work with, working primarily in the tech sector, do they always leave, you know, customer profiling and user profiling to the last minute? Or are you seeing much more of that initial design coming, profiling and market research happening first, because many of the products that you deal with have consumer facing products as well as enterprise level products?
Well, there's a few things in what you said, but I would say yes. I think there's definitely, compared to a number of years ago, there's a greater emphasis in tech on trying to understand the users who are going to kind of implement and leverage that product on a daily basis. I think that's absolutely true. But it's, you know, that famous quote, the future's already here, but it's not evenly distributed, right? I mean, like, it's not evenly distributed. I mean, large enterprise companies sometimes struggle to get out of their own way. Sometimes they'll continue to ship a product that's deficient because it has existing market share and they struggle to fix it, or it has a lot of features in it that they don't really know how to carve that surface area up to make it more comprehensible. But yeah, and I think the other factor is there's just a lot better feedback loops. I mean, if you offer a cloud service today, the amount of telemetry you have on your user base is stunning compared to, again, if we're talking about 20 years ago, right? I mean, so, but even there, a lot of that answers the question of like what they're doing and how they're doing it, but it never really answers the why. Like, it doesn't answer why they're avoiding a feature or why they're not using a part of the interface that you think they should. And those kinds of questions are just, you know, spot on good for things like qualitative research and the like.
Yes. And again, if you're dealing with pain primarily as the driver, does that bring in creativity as a result of that? Or do you find that there's just, let's just fix this problem and then move on? Do you find yourself in a position where you're able to drive these customers to a new level of, you know, of product design?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing I think everybody lives for around here is, at least on the research side for sure, is we delivered some findings. There was some recommendations. And at some point, sometimes it's weeks or months. If it's a really complicated decision, it might take a year. We look back and that company's different. I mean, that's really what we live for. I mean, we can't always guarantee it because, I mean, as anybody knows, like, you can put great information in front of somebody and great data and even a great recommendation, and you might have somebody say, I just believe differently based on gut instinct or whatever. And that may play out for them or it may not. But honestly, that's one of the biggest things we aim for, is trying to change these companies in some meaningful way, right? I mean, otherwise, why do the research at all at the end of the day?
I think the biggest challenge that you've got, presumably, is coming up with insightful market research that uncovers things that the companies that you work with weren't actually looking for in the first place, but benefit.
And that really has to do with, and this may be more nerdy about the market research industry than is necessary, but the reality is the market research industry is just full, like objectively full of vendors who serve all kinds of different audiences. Like, you know, they'll do one project on M&Ms and then they'll do another one with healthcare and then they'll do another one with oil and gas. And they're very methodologically driven. Like, oh, we do this kind of analysis really well, so we can do it for everyone. But the problem where that falls apart in market research, I think, and it's why we've only stayed focused on a certain type of customers. Like if you're a hospital and you call us, I mean, hey, it's great. You got a problem, but I'll try to direct you to somebody else, but we're never going to work with you. You know, you got a lot of money and a lot of revenue. I get that. But like, we don't know hospitals. And the reason I say all that is like, I don't think you can give great recommendations. I don't even think you can find the right participants all that effectively for a study, because some of it in B2B is really understanding who you add to the study and what backgrounds they have and do they have the right kind of opinions to share. I mean, the whole process of doing the research all the way down to the recommendations basically requires context. And if you don't have the context and all you have is the method, yeah, you might ship data at best, but you're never going to really be able to interpret it. And then the other problem is you're never really going to be able to have, I don't want to say an argument happens at the end of every research study, but there may be a little bit of truth to it. Like at the end of every research study, we deliver anything that's truly meaningful, right? That really is going to drive change. There's always somebody in the company who believes differently. It only stands to reason. So there's this moment where the research has to bounce off that person's kind of opinion. And at that point, we have to have enough context to be able to stand behind the findings and really kind of say, no, this is really happening in your market and you need to react to it. You really, really do. And if you're kind of this broad generalist, I don't think you can really do that. And so, you know, what's the downside to us? Well, you know, we have to manage our growth appropriately within the sector we're in. We can't just take everything that comes through the door. But honestly, philosophically, I think that's a great way to fly. I mean, you know, from my standpoint.
And I think I agree, because what happens is you then end up with insight that you wouldn't have got, which then allows you to guide your clients rather than saying to them, you know, you give us the questions that you need, and we'll go and ask them. But is it far more challenging operating in the B2B space than B2C? Because the amount of information that you can get is presumably limited to the contacts that you have. Trying to get someone in a business environment to respond to surveys or to answer your questions, you know, is that a major challenge that you have?
Well, yeah, absolutely. But that's one hill we had to climb early on. And honestly, a lot of it has to do with the outreach. Even, I mean, the targeting matters because you have to be talking to the right person, but really the outreach and how it's structured matters a great deal. And in a way, it's much like kind of an outbound sales team, right? To get someone to respond, to get someone to slow up enough to read your email, because that's the first barrier, right? You're scanning emails and hitting mark is red, you're reading subject lines. It has to have something in there. And really, the only way to make that happen is to kind of understand the audience you're trying to outreach to and write an effective piece of outreach. Whereas conversely, if you're working with all these different sectors all the time, all you can do is kind of a blast that's fairly generic.
Yes.
You know, although what I would say the other problem with market research when you come to B2C and B2B is really actually a slightly different one, which is that, not that what you mentioned isn't a challenge, it is. Market researchers have an easier time in B2C for probably one simple reason. They buy the things they're researching 9 times out of 10. Yeah. They themselves can kind of project a little bit of what is going to happen in that purchase funnel. Now they shouldn't do that, and they probably don't do that to a large extent, but they can conceptualize what a box of cereal is because they buy boxes of cereal. In B2B, to your point, things are a lot more opaque unless you really actually understand that buying cycle and the chain and the products that are sold. You know, it's like if one day I had to go work with oil and gas, I'd have to spend 10 years figuring out the oil and gas industry before I could give the same strength of recommendation I can now. Because I don't know what happens on an oil derrick. I mean, I don't. And I don't know what the whole infrastructure looks like to take oil from that derrick back to the refinery and all the different things that go into that. And so I think what happens in B2C is that the researcher can at least understand what that purchase funnel looks like because they experience it themselves. In B2B, well, unless you've lived it for a while, there's just no way to do that.
And the challenge really is finding people. Let me rewind slightly. So you have to be good at marketing. You have to be able to demonstrate your ability to do the things that you're selling to your client before you can actually get any information. So you've actually got a very challenging business because you have to be able to prove your ability to engage customers. Your marketing has to work. Otherwise, you don't get any feedback. And the feedback and the information you get from your clients, that's what you're selling. So do you find that you have to be constantly, not reinventing yourself, but constantly trying to fine-tune your approach to be able to get the information you need to make it, to turn that into valuable information?
Yeah. I mean, just one little footnote is, like, I mean, we're not syndicated research. So whatever our clients are telling us is proprietary and information we don't disclose. I mean, the research studies are private, because when you said, like, you know, we take some of the information and then kind of use it to market, that's not true, but you're right. We have to be constantly attenuating to basically what's happening in the marketplace. So we're always aware of what's going on and on top of kind of trends and market forces. And, you know, we know how to outreach to different audiences and we know kind of what's driving them. And again, that's one of the beauties of being a research firm, is you're kind of embedded in that all the time anyway, as long as you don't spread yourself out across a million different things.
Understood. But the information you get, so you've been doing this for, you know, 20 years or so. Are there common threads that you see emerging from a large number of the conversations that you're having that you can share with me, because no one else is listening? So it's just between you and me. No one will know. Key things, where key layers of insight that you find time and time again with the clients that you work with, that are problems that they've created or problems that just are naturally there in the industry.
That's a really good question. One of the perennial ones is that our clients aim too high with their marketing. Always. Like, they know deep down that it's interesting. I've never said this in an interview, but there's a guy at our gate trying to get in and I need to text him so my wife can let him in. So I've got to go do this. That's my wife. She'll let you in. Okay. So basically, they aim too high with their marketing is what they do. They have this weird problem where on the sales side, they remember basically that the person who was the ultimate gatekeeper was like the CIO or the C-level or somebody like that. And so then their marketing becomes, how do we get the CIO, C-level, et cetera, to pay attention to us? And what we rarely see is somebody do what intuitively you know they know, but they don't do it. Who's coming to the website? Is it the C-level? No. It's probably the most junior person in the organization that's been delegated, go find vendor. And yet none of the messaging on the site is designed to make that person take the next step. It's all much broader, bigger picture messaging that's like, hey, you as a C-level, you as an organization are going to take this product and it's going to change your life. And yet at the same time, really what you're trying to do is facilitate the purchase funnel by get that first person, that relatively junior person, to feel confident to move you forward, right? Like, they don't need all the details, right? And that's where, you know, things like testimonials might matter more, or the logos you've worked with more, or it might be even more kind of messaging that's targeted at the benefit of your solution to that junior level person. Like, if they advocate for you, how are their lives better? And we hardly ever see that. We bring it up all the time. And I think it's way easier in a meeting to say, you know, these last 10 deals we lost when we got into the office of the CIO, so we need better messaging for the CIO. When really, that's the sales funnel. Yes, eventually in the sales funnel, you get to the C-level's office. But the C-level probably, actually, I doubt they ever visited your site, even if they signed a bazillion-dollar contract with you. Why would they? That's not what they do all day. And so there's this weird, like, kind of hierarchical disconnect when it comes to personas in the marketing. And the other big thing I would say is that we tell people this all the time. Tell people what you don't do. Like, tell them what you don't do, because in tech, they know all software is bad in some way, right? Yeah. I mean, it all has failings. It all has rough edges. And instead of forcing them to kind of go through your website to try to find what you don't do, or worse yet, tell competitors, let competitors define it for you, right? And they're the ones that say, oh, you suck in this way or that way. It's much more powerful to just tell people, like, these are the audiences and the areas that we don't serve. But people are very reluctant to do that, even though they know there's clearly parts of the market that they're not going to access anytime soon. So
you're answering my next question, which is, what are the things that the most successful companies that you work with do? Are there common, elements that really successful companies that have launched a new product. So we're not talking about the established players. We're talking about upstart companies who managed to gain significant market share, punch way above their weight. What are the things that they do that differentiate them from other people in their class?
To a large extent, I think they do a good job of defining where their market is in the early days and sticking to it. And I would say that's true of almost anybody I've ever worked with, even down to the level of small services firms. I mean, it's so tempting to keep adding customer bases, right? It's so, so tempting. And even in my own entrepreneurial journey, and I'll give you an example of like a really large company that comes to mind when I think about this kind of mistake. And then, you know, what companies do well is like, there was a period when we started Cascade where like, you know, I started doing a lot of speaking engagements. And then all of a sudden I was in like Singapore and Hong Kong and in Europe and all this stuff. And so we started to get all these clients from all over the place and all these different sectors. And this happened for about like 6 to 9 months. And then I realized there was no way we were going to be able to give great insight to Exxon and Merck and Microsoft and a bunch of people in different sectors. So we pared it all back and we actually gave up on companies like an Exxon or a Merck, which I know somebody out there screaming like, how in the world would you ever do that? I mean, maybe some people just would love to hate on Exxon but anyway, they had a lot of revenue.
Yeah.
And so I think there's that inability to limit who you serve in the beginning and kind of the inability to evangelize specific low-level audiences that are really going to drive your initial marketing makes sense. I mean, Tableau comes to mind as an example of a company that did that very well early on. You know, they tried to make people kind of superheroes at the lower end of the market.
Yeah.
You see that with a lot of interesting kind of smaller SaaS solutions these days. I think on the side of the ledger of where things can go bad, you know, a company, I won't mention their name, but they're a fairly large mid-market SaaS player. And their CMO sent us an email once that basically said, we need help. We serve 2,000 different distinct customer bases right now. And how they got there was they basically just kept everybody that wanted to fill out their credit card and give it, you know, buy a license they were willing to go work with. And then eventually that creates all these kinds of problems because it's like, well, how do I convert those customers to larger paying customers? Well, they're all different types of customers. How do I market to them? So initially it feels great because the boat's just filling up with dollars, right? And then at some point you can't really do things effectively across all those different customer bases. So I could summarize really successful companies say no to opportunity sometimes.
And again,
they do it for an extended period of time. I mean, Apple's a good example. I mean, Apple's expanded some of their service profile, but this isn't a company that all of a sudden decided they wanted to offer like, you know, everything to everyone. I mean, they've tried to stay focused. And I think there's a lot of power to that. And so that'd be my advice, folks, that we've seen to be successful.
And do you see this issue representing itself in the design or the development of the software itself, where in an effort to try and be all things to all people, the product just gets bigger and fatter and heavier and slower? And I think the term bloatware sort of springs to mind. So have you seen that? Is it so much easier to try and overdevelop your solution to try and capture everyone rather than making the hard decisions.
Yeah. By far. I mean, you know, I mean, I think that happens pretty regularly. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's so endemic. I don't know if I could say anything other than it happens all the time. I mean, like pretty much all of our clients, like don't know how to limit their features and capabilities in a meaningful way at times. You know, there's always one other audience, one other knob they want to add. And that creates, you know, havoc if you let it go on for too long.
And again, where's this driven from? Is it the CIO? Is it the founders of the companies? Is it the technical side that want to just build stuff? In your experience with the technical companies that you work with, you know, how drowned out is the marketing officer's voice in these scenarios until it becomes a problem?
Well, I think it's interesting. It depends on the type of company. There was a book I read once called Stall Points that's always stayed with me. It's a fantastic book. It's not really all that well heralded. But if you talk about large companies, I think where the blind spot comes in is that whatever the founding product was tends to warp a lot of the company's thinking. And you see this over and over and over and over again. The Stall Points made a point of saying, looking at the board for these large companies, if you look and see where these people started their careers, it's always in like the founding business unit. So Microsoft for decades was warped by like, everything has to be about Windows. Everything has to be about Windows and we have to sell Windows. You know, Mac was warped for years by the Mac, right? And you can make an argument that today, as much as the iPhone's successful, they're being a little bit warped by the iPhone, right? Maybe there is some innovation they could be doing in other places and other ways, right? For sure. And so I think there's, on large companies, that's the issue. I think for small companies, the issue is that the founding team usually started off well because they had kind of innate market intelligence. They understood something about the market, and that's how they got funding, and that's how they got support. But then at some point, they're not the ones talking to the market anymore. You know, that really smart CEO and founder, he's not having conversations with buyers anymore. And so a certain number of years or months go by, depending on how fast their market's moving. And then there's this gulf that happens, and then ego gets in the way. Yep. I mean, an example of that, there was a very well-known CDN supplier. And I remember this story vividly because it just sticks out to me. And the CEO, based in the Bay, I think there's a lot of CDN suppliers based in the Bay, so it's probably not giving much away. And so this individual says, you know, well, we don't need to do any branding. We don't need to do any marketing because we're really, really well known. Well, they're in the Bay. Like, I mean, they probably got a billboard on every stretch of 101 and everybody can see them, right? And that's a bit of a soup down there of everybody knows everybody. And if you're a tech company, you probably get a lot of visibility fairly quickly because that's what the whole area is about. This individual goes back to their hometown, which happened to be a city in Canada. I won't say which one because then it starts to give it away a little bit, and basically gives a talk. No one knew about them. No one, not a soul. And so the marketing team had been like, we need brand mark. We, you know, and the sales team had been like, we can't sell in any other market. We just can't. Nobody knows us. And the CEO is like, come on, everybody knows us, right? Well, what had happened is they'd grown out of the Bay and they'd grown into other regions. And there was that mapping of what the CEO thought they knew about the market, and that was no longer true. So you could almost say that really what you worry about in the startup side is how connected is your leadership day to day to customer conversations, market conversations, interactions with competitors. And if you could almost graph that gap, then you'll know when you're in a danger zone, when you're starting to make decisions with incomplete information. And the other place I would say is, this is another one, is that sometimes companies will hire competitor employees and they'll say, well, that's how we'll get the information, right? You used to work for so-and-so, and sure, don't share anything NDA, but you can tell us a little bit about what's going on. Even those people should have an expiration date on, right? They, at some point, they don't understand what's happening in the competitor, particularly in tech. I mean, if you're no longer working for a tech company a year later, outside of cultural aspects, you probably don't know anything.
Yes.
Because tech companies move so fast, like, how do you even remotely know what's going on over there? But then what happens is that person is seen a little bit like a seer inside the company. And every time there's a meeting about said competitor, they ring in Bob or Mary and they say, so Mary, what do you think about the competitor? So and Mary very wisely says what she knows, but Mary worked there 7 years ago.
Yeah. So you've got 1 year's worth of knowledge that's 10 years old.
Right, right. It should have like a milk expiration on it, right? Yes. And it's like, it's done. And so, but this is a self-monitoring thing in a lot of ways, right? You're the leadership team. Nobody's going to tell you that. Somebody seven levels beneath you isn't going to tell you you don't know what you're talking about. That usually doesn't happen.
Yeah, but someone has to be there to say that. So in other words, if you've got that, I wouldn't say dysfunctional board, but, you know, typically as businesses grow, then there are gaps that emerge in certain areas, and, you know,
Tech. And usually the performance of the business dictates that. And then all of a sudden somebody, an investor or somebody else says, wait a minute, there's something we don't know. But that takes us all the way back a little bit to part of what happens when we deliver research is there's a bit of an argument. And that argument is usually that moment where somebody is trying to map what they thought they knew about the market to what we're telling them about the market. And they're trying to bridge that gap mentally.
Is it like the five stages of grief? Do you have
Right. And we're going to be better suited to do that if we have the context about the market that we can say, yeah, we get it. We understand the pattern you're dealing with, but it doesn't take away the reality of the pattern. And so, you know, then we can kind of coach them on what to do. Right. So, but there's definitely this moment of like kind of crisis and catharsis that if the research findings are really impactful and the company's really experiencing kind of a good pain or opportunity moment, there's almost always this little cathartic moment that has to happen for them to really make change.
And do you find that if you put your, you know, three C-level executives in a room and ask each one of them, you know, what are the key messages that your company delivers, or, you know, what is your company about? Do you find in most cases when you're actually working with them, you get three completely different answers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my favorite story on that was I read an HBR article once that basically said, in terms of like companies not knowing how many messages they're communicating internally, even and to the market, like how many directives they're basically thinking they're shaping themselves around. They went in and I don't get the numbers exactly right, but it was something like they go to the CEOs of these companies. They say, how many strategic objectives do you feel your company is executing on based on what you've communicated? And they're like, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10, 12. Then they go talk to all the lieutenants. When they add up the number of strategic directives the company is operating on, it was something like 180. Because what had happened is the CEO and the founding party had said something in a meeting someday.
Yeah.
And somebody had decided that was important. And because nobody checked down and said, well, should we even do this? I mean, anyway, so there's a lot of that. And the corollary to that, too, is that, and I want to be clear, like, because not everything has to change. Like, to throw something in, I always think about at times like this. G.K. Chesterton has this great story where he talks about whether you're allowed to change something and whether you should. And in this story, he basically tells, and in the actual written version, it's way better than this shorthand, but he says, you know, somebody wants to go change the gate and they want to remove it. And I say, basically, if you can tell me why the gate exists, I will let you remove it. But until you tell me why it was here in the first place, I won't let you get rid of it. And so there is a little bit, you know, this corollary to like, hey, I've lost sight of the market and things must change. Before you make the change, make sure that you understand why it exists to begin with. And that takes us all the way back to context. A lot of times we can understand why they were doing what they're doing. Like in the example of that SaaS company that had like 2,000 different use cases. Well, we get it. You're a SaaS company. You've got a form that says, here's my credit card and your productivity kind of software, basically, right? It makes sense that anybody on the planet might sign up for you. We understand that. Doesn't mean that you should stay where you are, right? And so, and I'd say that's true of a lot of senior leaders. I would just a general coaching point. I would say, if you want a senior leader to change, start by telling him or her, you know, well, I mean, you know, in quotes, you understand why they are making the decisions they're making. You understand how they got to where they are today. And even though you understand that, you think something should change. Most people just jump over that part. They never explain to anybody why the fence is there to begin with. And what you find out is sometimes they don't know. And then it's really dangerous to let them make a change, well, right? Because then they're just making a change for change sake. What's that?
It's there because it's always been there. That's the answer.
Well, right. Yes. And then nobody really knows. And so anyway, it's something I think about fairly often. So anyway.
And just a tiny sort of sidetrack. New technologies, when they come along, how hard is your job then to try and shape the market? Because if you look at blockchain technologies, for example, this sort of fairly nebulous, undefined suite of products that you know are beginning to emerge. Do you work with blockchain companies? Do you work with companies that develop new types of technologies of that sort of ilk? And what sort of challenges do they have compared to just trying to break into a market where there are already well-defined parameters?
Yeah, I mean, we deal with that maybe a little bit less because sometimes they're so new and they're so small, they don't really have the ability to do any research at all, right? You know, it's kind of like that side. But I would say that the biggest initial question those companies have to ask themselves, and this isn't true about blockchain, like blockchain is being used by lots of people, but like, does anybody even want what you want, right? I mean, tech is innovating things all the time. I mean, it may be that like, we don't need a 17th note-taking app. Yes. I mean, we just don't. That may be hard for you to hear, but we don't. I mean, Capiche, it's not a free plug. I just like the newsletter, yes. But Capiche is doing like this note-taking winners bracket take all survey thing over the last few weeks. Right. And it's like, there's like 20 major note-taking apps now. Right. I mean, it can't possibly survive. I get that Evernote eventually got crufty and sucked and everybody kind of wanted something different, you know, in the days where Evernote was like the only thing we thought of with note-taking. But if somebody wants to be the 21st note-taking app, maybe the answer is no. Right. And then the other one is, you know, can you actually like articulate your value prop in a way that is compelling, right? And that, I know that's a little bit simplistic, but we see that a lot. Like we'll talk to somebody and it's just, they just don't know really how to do that well.
Yes.
They just don't. And they jump over it. And I don't know. It seems like an elemental thing, but if you ask that kind of growing startup, like, quit telling me about your potential. Can you just explain what you do in a very simplistic way?
Yeah, exactly.
They really
yeah.
struggle to do that, which is why, like, you know, people may like or not like my pain and opportunity ditty, But it works for us and everybody yes. understands it. Like I go talk to clients and I say, you're going to hire us for one of two reasons. And you'll probably hire us for one over the other one. And they're again, like, oh, well, I, okay, I can't remember. I get it.
It was someone pretty famous and pretty smart who said, who wrote a speech. I think it might have been Churchill who said, it would have been shorter if I'd have had more time.
Oh, so, it was Mark Twain. And Mark Twain.
Was it Mark Twain?
Sorry. Yeah. Mark, because I use that quote a lot. Although people say it wasn't even Mark Twain, because Mark Twain was creative, I think. I think he picked up a lot of things. He wrote some very amazing stuff himself, but I think he was an aggregator, a little bit like Churchill.
Yeah, yeah,
too, right?
Information
and I, Churchill's very quotable too, but like I've used a ton of his quotes, but like, yeah, Twain said, I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, brevity is really, really hard. Yes. Yeah. And it takes refinement to get there. And I talked to a startup today that I won't say who they are. I like them. They're going to be a new client, but the CEO got on and I think he took 10 minutes to explain what they do. You know,
well, and of course you wouldn't understand.
Well, interesting is in this case, because we understand the space we do, which let me kind of at least interpret what he was saying. But to your point, I don't know if that would have been a compelling customer conversation. If that's what they're going to go,
that's a hell of an elevator pitch, I tell you. You know,
right? He's just going through the whole thing, and I'm like, and anyway, so good guy. Like, I don't want to knock him too hard, but they look like they're going to do well overall. But
yeah, well, I can. Yes, you know, that's the thing. It's going full circle, isn't it? When people realize that, you know, small is, you know, less is more, succinct. If you can explain what you do in simple terms that everyone understands, then that probably means that you've got something that's highly valuable. Is that a...
Well, the last thing I'd say on that too, because I know we're probably getting tight on time, but like the thing I'd say is that that's a corollary, I think, with even saying what you don't do. Like people go to your website, and I think today it's what we do with Amazon reviews, right? Do we sort by most favorable or least favorable? Most of us... Unfortunately, pessimistically, we all know, let's look at the one stars.
That's where the truth is, apparently.
That's where the truth is, right? Because the five stars are like paid for or who knows what. And so it's weird in that when we've gotten people to think about it that way and they say what they don't do and they do it, it's amazingly powerful. Because I think what you're doing these days is you're just instantly creating trust, because people are desperate when they read a piece of information these days. And I think this is a broader statement than B2B, but I think that's kind of obvious. Yes. They're desperate to figure out where it's not saying the truth. And so they will hunt and peck and look for that all around.
That's a very good analogy. The Amazon analogy is a very good analogy, I think, because I think everyone can relate to that. So
yeah, you got it. And I think so if you do that and you have the gift of brevity, right, in your messaging, if you can marry brevity with this is what we don't do, at least today, I think it's an incredibly winning combination. And what people do instead is, as we talked about, they don't really know how to be brief.
Yes.
And they say they do everything. And then the poor soul on your website just goes off somewhere else looking to figure out what you don't do, which is probably a third-party review site.
Yeah.
Which again, they're sorting by one stars looking to see what you don't do. Right.
I mean that itself is hugely valuable information. Just, you know, it's looking through the lens the other way, looking at it from a consumer's perspective, as opposed to let's just, you know, throw everything. But you're right. I think we should move on because I have some super brief questions here that I want to ask.
Sure. Go for it. Yeah.
As part of my Hooked on Startups quick fire questionnaire. Do we need a drum roll? So Sean Campbell, founder and CEO of Cascade Insights. Question number one, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word, and I have to admit, this is the one time I didn't want to think these up on the spot. So I bothered to go take a look at this. So it's probably a phrase, can we? I'm kind of like more of a, can we go out? Can we go camping? Can we go fishing? Can we? I mean, I don't say I get bored easily. I can remain focused on things, but I like to do things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I just like, so it's can we is probably it. So go ahead.
Great. And question number two, what is your least favorite word?
This one I struggle with. I have to tell you, I don't know. I love the English language. I love turns of phrase. So I have stuff for other ones. I don't know this one. I got to be honest. I couldn't really think of one that's like my least favorite word in the English language. I mean, tongue in cheek, I'd probably say no. But then, like I just said, I really think it's important to say what you don't do. So it can't be that.
I'm not really sure.
Hoisted
by your own petard.
Right.
So we'll move on. Question number three, what are you most excited about right now?
Fishing. This is the end of fishing season. It's summer is it's usually a glorious time to be on the water. We went fishing for my birthday this past weekend with the family, caught a bunch of bass. So fishing's now, if you call me in December or January, the answer to this question would be skiing, because that's what I turn to then. So
fantastic. And question number four, what turns you off right now?
People who take in a limited amount of information to make their decisions. And I would say that is beyond the business environment. I think that's a thing that drives me crazy. Like, here's my one data source. I'm going to convince you everything that's wrong with the world with that one source.
Drives the sample me of one.
Totally. Right. N of one is not good decision making. So
question five, what sound or noise?
Sound would be the sound of a boat in the water, or in the winter, skis on snow. There's something just to me about the sound of that water slapping against the side of the boat.
I was going
to
say waves lapping against the side of the boat.
Waves lapping against it. Yeah, you got it.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
Snoring. My dog, I love my dog, but he snores like a freight train. Yeah. So if he sleeps in our room, it's like I have to go somewhere else and he gets to sleep there. So
yeah, and you can't. Yeah, I know that you can't say anything, poor things.
No, not really. But he snores very loudly at times.
Yeah. And what's your favorite curse word?
You know, I grew up in Chicago where it's certain words like that were used as adjective nouns and adverbs, but they're...
Is it time for a new one, do you think?
No. I honestly tried to dial a bit of that back. So I would say right now I don't have one, but yes, as a younger man, I definitely had ones that were used as probably everything. But yeah,
The universally adaptive word. Exactly.
Yeah, yes. You got it.
And my question number eight, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Fishing guide or ski instructor, probably.
And what profession would you not like to attempt?
Anything where I don't get to solve problems and I have to do the same thing all day long, which is probably a zillion of those.
And hell for you, Sean Campbell, is, yes, sitting on an assembly line. Yes.
Yeah, totally. And not solving problems.
Right? Having a boss who has read one line in the newspaper and then knows everything.
Right. That would be right up there too. Yeah,
actually, absolutely. I think I've just answered your next question. So question number 10, the final question. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Well, I would say, one, it does exist. And I would just say, thank you for everything you've done for me.
Fantastic.
Sean, if I'm there, that's the only thing I think you should say. That's right, at that point. Yes.
It's been such a pleasure. And thank you for such, you know, amazing distilled wisdom. Final question. How do people get in touch with you and with Cascade Insights?
Just Sean at CascadeInsights.com. Always happy to talk to entrepreneurs. You know, if you're not a fit for the company, I'm always happy to just be a coach and just a shoulder to lean on if you've got questions just about the world of owning a business. But if you're looking for kind of the kind of work we do and you're a B2B technology company, go to CascadeInsights.com.
That's fabulous. Great. Thank you once again. And such a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, man. Great chat.